it's a doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. Hear that lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me wanna go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pound to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign, 90.1 FM dial.
And Dave on the board. You know what? I never look at a clock or anything. What's today's date?
24th.
Today's the 24th, something like that.
24th of July.
July. And as of 2016. I'm still waiting 1996 on my checks, too. So, and as always, this is the Prairie Monk, which is a discussion.
I had a problem printing out my summary. But I've been to the Prairie Conference, and it was rather fantastic. I'll try and give you an idea of what went on at the Prairie Conference. It was very close this year at Bloomington, Illinois, so there was a lot of participants from Champaign and East Central Illinois, Iowa, but there were also people from New York and from Montana and Louisiana and a lot of participants from the state natural resources people, and just an interesting get-together. It's a fairly young field. This is the 24th conference, and it's a biennial conference. It takes a lot of work to put it together, and don't always easily have dormitories in summer who provide fairly inexpensive living space. It also is a little bit of a problem because this is the peak of prairie activity, and so there's a lot of local things that are happening that prevent people from going to a prairie conference. The field trips were excellent, and you get the feedback from people as they come back from various field trips. You can't cover everything. You hear stories here and there. And there are exhibitors. And you get together and communicate. The keynote address was given by Mike Jeffords from the Natural History Survey, retired now. He and Susan Post do a lot of work with nature. And he is a very good photographer, and wanted to stress the fact that we don't know a lot about the prairie. It's not a very well-funded field. Things that get funded are things that are a problem. So if you have a corn root worm that's a problem, then you'll get funding for that. But for the documentation of natural history of a little beetle or a fly or a praying mantis is not high on the economic scale of research. But they're there, and they're exciting, and there are people who know their onions about what they are and what they do. Not always are they sure what they do. So Jeffords was encouraging in that manner. That keynote address was followed by four invited guests, and they mostly spoke about the field areas, Natchusa Prairie, the Kankakee sand prairies in Indiana and Illinois, Fermilab, and there was one other all-day field trip to the western Illinois sand prairies, which I attended. Trying to think what was on my notes. There were specific participant speeches, and they contributed. You couldn't go to all, but you could get an idea of the things that were important. There were discussion groups where everyone got to participate if they were willing enough and game enough and there was time enough for them to be heard. They were the leaders of the push. And some have passed on. Some are very much still here, but retired. Conference was put together with a steering committee, and one of the leaders there was Fran Hardy, who is with the Nature Conservancy, and the Nature Conservancy had a fair input into this conference because it was Nature Conservancy has a fair input into the Sand Prairie and Kankakee, the Natusa Prairie, and I suspect quite a few other things too. Jamie Ellis locally was doing a cemetery field trip, and that was attended by Jack White, which is kind of helpful because Jack has a historical background to these prairies, and some of these prairies are adjacent to railroad right-of-ways, which are some of our only remaining prairies. Interestingly, when you hit a field with a bunch of experts, they tend to disperse. They come together when they find something, and sometimes they are finding things that are different from what the leader would be talking about. Sometimes there were different structures. There were items to catch field insects, techniques to do that, little traps in the sand prairie, for instance, to catch small creatures. Interesting to have people who are willing to share all the botanical names or most of the botanical names, but the botanical names have been going up and down and being changed as DNA and RNA are being and gene pools are being checked out. Sometimes a plant looks like it's related to morphologically to another plant, but then it's found that it has a different base. So the Linnaean documentation of plants, the Latin names, are often changing groups and even changing names. And new plants are found. And also there are quite a few plants that are so rare that they're going to disappear quickly. And climate change will have an influence on that. There were exhibitors, mostly non-profits and state agencies, but there were also commercial people, and some of the commercial people are big time. They have they may be seeding 10,000 acres of prairie, so they need equipment that's very different from what small-time people are involved with. There is an international flavor to some of this. If you're going to settle on one bird like the bobolink and preserve its flyway or its destination for nesting, then if it migrates to Brazil or Peru or somewhere else in South America, then you have to know that habitat is being preserved too, and that is not always the case. So you have to look at a broad picture. There are also scientists there, and basically the prairie people are very willing to say, we don't know. There's a lot of things we do not know, so please, if you are in the audience and you know something, or you suspect something, or you suspect that we're out of line with what you've been reading or what you've been experiencing, please let us know. There was one situation where a scientist was presenting a paper on plovers, and plovers tend to live and nest in sort of disturbed areas where all their burrows are. So they can at one time be up and standing like cute little creatures listening to you and giving their little squeaks and barks. Then they can all disappear if a hawk or something like that is arrives. Well, the plovers have a very simple nest, and the female lays the eggs, and the male hatches the eggs. And in the meantime, the female goes off and forms another nest. She may even be have another male, and so there might be three nests. And that discussion was good. Dave, could you run the printer and print my...
In fact, that's exactly where I was just now. This is Dave, the sidekick over here. Whoops. Dave has forgotten which control goes for what. Yes, I was, in fact, while you were just talking, I was next door trying to get your printer to run. I've told it to print, and I'm waiting to see if anything happens.
Okay.
So in the meantime, I brought you your guide so that
yes.
You've at least got something as a reference.
I was talking about plovers. Plovers living with prairie dogs. Prairie dogs have had a huge negative occupancy in the West. They were poisoned. They were exterminated in many ways. And almost extinct. They've come back, but they have an unfortunate disease. So that was discussed some. The birds are there very close. So one of the scientific questions there is the plover near enough to the prairie dog burrows to provide a transfer of the disease? Another thing is that the birds are vulnerable to coyotes and other creatures, and could they smell things that were put in the plover's nest? The plover might put lichens in there and also some dung, and it was thought that that would deter a coyote from taking the eggs. Someone who has had given a lecture on the capacity of dogs to smell plants and biochemicals was not sure that something as simple as lichens and dung would be enough to deter a coyote. The question is then that probably she and the presenter will probably go back to the research and figure out whether that is a correct statement. Or sometimes once you decide on something, it gets to be almost a fact, and it may not be. We know that from other fields where brain concentration was thought to be not as viable as it really is, and so that field has changed a lot. Well, the same with prairies, which are really needing a lot of attention, a lot of research, and some of these papers bring forth the need for research. The questions about burning. Burning is essential to prairie growth. It takes away the litter and lets the heat and the light get into the prairie early in spring. It can explode seeds that are will be more viable once a prairie fire has been through. But it happens naturally with lightning, and then happens with Indian involvement and then Caucasian involvement. But most Caucasians did not want to burn things. And there was Smokey the Bear that sort of discouraged burning. And you see what's happening in Southern California, where there's been a drought for 5 years and everything is very tinder dry. Well, so all those things prevent burning. You have to relate to city councils, to park districts, for forest preserves, and the weather is a major challenge. If you have rain in the spring when you often burn, there's a need to sometimes delay your burning, and if you delay it, and then the snakes and the creatures are out and you can't burn. So there's a small window where you can burn. The state people are very worried that not enough burning is being done on remnant prairies to keep them active. So the prairies don't only deteriorate, but they also just don't exist. There are other people who have been looking at remnant prairies, like John Taft, who was reminding us that when you research remnant cemetery prairie or another established remnant, the mowing and the activity to the edge of the prairie can often reduce the amount of prairie that is there, because the invasives that are more willing to work with mowing, for instance, Queen Anne's lace and chicory, they're going to take over some of the space of the prairie that is there, or the prairie that may have been planted. There are poster opportunities, and they were very good. You didn't always get time to read them, but if you took time, you ended up with interesting information. There's a group headed by Bill I forgot his name, but they're doing surveys of roadside prairies, there are people who are willing to say you need for a good prairie to have 1,000 acres, but if you don't have 1,000 acres, you had better watch those tiny little pieces of remnant that are left. They're very endangered. The price of corn has gone up. The yield of GMOs has gone up. Elevators are going in. And all those tiny little pieces of triangular corners of fields that carry prairie, like the English prairie at Kempton, getting put back into agriculture, or put into agriculture when they've never been in agriculture before. So there's a way of defining what a prairie is. They put numbers on items that grow easily, or like bee balm will grow easily. So if you're on a 1 to 10 scale, the bee balm might be a 5. It will grow easily. So yellow coneflower grows easily, and especially in about the fourth year. New England aster grows fairly easily. The silphiums, compass plant and dock, which are exceedingly doing very well at the present time, are perhaps number 4 and 5. Get into lead plant and culver's root, and you're talking about a number 7 or a number 8. Get into some of those rare plants like orchids, and you might be up to 10. So there are surveys that not only do roadsides, but they do remnants with the hope that they'll preserve for the future. Other people are dealing with equipment. We used to use a Nesbitt drill, but that has given way to a Truick drill. Now that drill allows for fluffy seeds that are like you would have a dandelion. You can imagine that doesn't drop down a dropper of a regular soybean or corn dropper, where you put a little cup and it brings around and the cup drops a seed down a dropper. You actually have to push that seed down, and you have to have something that stirs it, or you'll have all the tiny little seeds in one place and all the fluffy seeds in another. So the drill people are there. There are big organizations that are dealing with large acreages, but there are people like the Prairie Moon who do small acreages. There are educators who want to take you to a cemetery and have to work with the local administrations, work with recent people who think that a cemetery should be mown when this cemetery might be a dead cemetery that hasn't been mown for 100 years, then he wants to use those cemeteries as teaching aids. There's a matter of sand prairies, and sand prairies that have been used for livestock and overgrazed. So what does overgrazing do to your prairie? I think we're covering some of the things that I wanted to talk about. Thanks to Dave to go on getting a printout from a computer.
Sure. Computers are always great fun. Since we're about halfway past the hour, how about I jump in really quickly and remind folks they're listening to The Prairie Monk. Today's date appears to be July the 24th, 2016, and Dave is talking mainly about the North American Prairie Conference, which is where he was from a week ago today through to when I guess he came back home here last Wednesday.
There was eco-agriculture, and that is where you take the ecology of the region and look at the trees, shrubs, herbs, and vines, and see if you can't replicate that in economic agricultural terms. So after meeting with one of those guys, I find that that come from Sydney. So this afternoon I will be visiting an eco-agriculture situation at Sydney, where you might put nut plants in the shrub area. You might put grapes there. You might put trees in apple trees in another place, and sort out your environment according to what was nature. and where these cultivated plants sit. The leaders of the push were there. The most interesting recent development has been Northern Iowa University, and that has taken on the responsibility for archiving some of this information, and they have been very helpful. Darryl Smith has been the person involved, and he has been very willing to work with also willing administrators, so the campus is largely prairie-oriented, and we can do with that sort of help. So Darryl was a leader on the steering committee, along with other people who also have their finger in the pie. And we need those people, and there are few enough of them. Some of them are historic, so they're passed on. There's a group of five people in the Chicago area that Floyd Fink and a whole bunch of others. And one of the main ones was a guy named Betts, Bob Betts. And they did a lot to find cemetery prairies and little spots of prairie that were not being attended to very well. And so there was one presentation about people who did that. There was a major presentation by Peter Schramm, who put together this North American Prairie Conference. He was head of the biology department at Knox College in Galesburg, and he brought together a group of some of these prairie friends and academics, and he also was quite able to talk to, encourage people to contribute in many ways. I have a suspicion he might have had a lot to do with prairie that's on Grant Park Garage in Chicago, little things like that. Working with the forest preserves at park districts is good. So I was prepared to say something about that, because one of the people that was the physicist that was involved with Fermi Lab, which Bob Betts had a lot to do with, I was familiar with because I went to a memorial service to Elizabeth Hansen, and her husband was a physicist, and he was in the Manhattan Group. They were one of the involvements here was research into a Van de Graaff. I'm not quite sure whether I've got the right term, but it's a spark making machine. And so following the sparks and things like that, you're looking at the structure of an atom, and those people were in Manhattan working on the bomb that eventually went to Japan. And after World War II, the next big project was a nuclear accelerator in Batavia, Illinois, which is about a mile in radius, and can speed up a target, a projectile that would hit a target, and then that nuclear magnetic resonance and other properties of the atom could be studied. Well, what's in the middle of the prairie, of the accelerator, is quite a few acres of potential prairie and prairie soil. So Bob Betts put in a little prairie, and he had to work with physicists like Goldwasser and Hansen, who were working in Champaign. So that was a little close to home, and a young fellow who is working with that prairie was interested in telling us about Bob Betts and some of his associates. We also have to think about where the next conference will be. So there was a meeting to deal with that. Always a problem because it requires fairly inexpensive dormitories rather than a battery of expensive hotels. And that's not easy to find. It's almost easier to find with community colleges than it is with major universities like the one we were at Bloomington. I was an exhibitor. Heartland Pathways was an exhibitor. I was a little bit surprised because I was anticipating being able to lean pictures up against the wall, but the whole ballroom was curtained. So I hung one of my statements about roadside prairies need policies up on the curtain. And when I went away to the field trip, somebody had put up a framework that would hang that in better shape. But I always enjoy selling T-shirts because I get to talk to people. They come with stories. We had a handout that David helped me do, and it was distributed very generously, and so about 60 people have handouts that they didn't have before. Some of the T-shirts were sold to people whose mothers had given them a T-shirt years ago. There were people from the Quad Cities area, people from western Minnesota. There was a person from LaGrange, and that was Wolf Road Prairie, where he volunteers. I got his story, and I had to remind him that my mother had come, and she's Australian, and taken her to Wolf Road Prairie, which was a little prairie that has all the streets built into it for development, but it never happens, and the prairie remains, and kind of somewhat protected by the streets. Well, mother was amazed by this sight, but she started to pick the flowers like she would do in Australia. And I had to say, Mother, you don't do that when this is as rare as it is here. So he came back. He lost his wallet. But he retrieved it later. So that sort of interaction allows us to know each other and to talk to each other and communicate. There were people from the Katy Trail, which is a very different rail trail because it was acquired by one person who did a lot of the acquisition of 200-mile railroad bed. So a difference. It was people from Florida. I want to say something about communications. How's the time?
You have 20 minutes.
20 minutes. I got into an elevator with a young woman who had been on a field trip, and we just started to discuss things. She came from the northeast portion of Indiana, and her group had a mission of planting eco-agriculture, I assume. Interestingly, she had read the handout and knew what we were doing, and I was finding out what she was doing in her group. We walked together and shared information, and then we parted, and I went to my booth and later sat down and without intent, sat down at the same table as the young woman. And what had happened was that the barbecue was to be outside, and it was to be a communication device where people got together. Unfortunately, or fortunately, people were watching the rain, and it was going to rain, and it did rain. So the barbecue became part of an interior banquet room with tables. So there's a tendency for people to gather together and sit down at the one table. So I am aware that was the intent was of a barbecue is often to get people together. So I moved off and took photographs of a very nice band. The table I was at had asked me if I was a musician because I was sort of dancing to the music. So I took a photograph or two of them, and then I wandered into a spot where there was a 10-person table with a lady on one side and a lady on the other side, and they were talking across the table. And I thought, well, that looks like a place where I could input some communication or add to things. It's always a little bit of a challenge because you don't like to interrupt an existing conversation. But it was interesting. The lady was from Omaha, Nebraska. Her husband was Glenn Pollock, who gave a talk about cemeteries and their use as teaching aids. And so on the other side was a young woman from New York. So how did someone from New York, from Brooklyn, get to be at this conference? Well, she's a gardener, and she was interested in different types of gardens. Actually, in the East, there are little pockets of prairie here and there, and you have to remember that things like New England aster come from New England. So, yes, there are the Pine Barrens in New Jersey and other places. So she was interested in looking at the native background to the cultivars that she was using. She looked in the internet and found the Prairie Conference and decided to come. And I think she was pleased to be there. The lady who was from Omaha, Glenn, her husband, came by and he got to learn that this other woman was from New York, and he got to share with her. I got to share too, because long ago, one of the last farms on Long Island near New York was being put to development, there was a large barn, and I was asked what could happen to the barn. Could it be preserved? And so I said, yes, let's ask the barn movers from Vermont if they might be interested. They said it was too far south for them to be interested, but it sounded interesting. So they flew down and eventually took the barn back in pieces to Vermont, replaced damaged or wormy beams. And the next question is, where would it go? And that had been determined beforehand. I asked if there were a Long Island farm museum or something like that. And, oh, sure, there was the Long Island Antiquities. And Long Island Antiquities had just lost their barn to fire. So they could really use this. So the Vermont people brought that barn back to the Long Island Antiquities, which is still farmland on the far east side of Long Island. So we discussed that sort of thing a little bit. But it said to me that this was communication. The guy from Wolf Road Prairie arrived with his wallet in hand and said, found it under the bed. And so just very, very friendly. And that was the intent of the of this sort of conference. Not a very sophisticated, not a very established field, but a lot of interested people, ranging from the wee folk, little folk, to people who have spent their lives preserving prairie. Later, I encountered the same person again. I'd sent her to the Prairie Moon booth, but Prairie Moon does a lot of small garden type things. And while I was there, I must still have been beating my foot to the music. And so somebody came up, and we all ended up dancing to the music. And so that sort of thing takes people off their seats and involves people. So when the band closed down, it was obvious that some of the people in the band were academic people.
What's time? 15 minutes.
Only 2 minutes?
15.
Okay. Yes. So I went on a field trip to Sand Prairies, and there on the western side of Illinois, and there the end to our Mahomet Aquifer. Our Mahomet Aquifer, if you take water into it here, may take 1,000 years to get down to the aquifer. It mightn't take that long, but it's a long time. It's down there. It might be down 200 feet or more, and it might be very diffuse. When it gets to Bidstown and Havana and those areas where it's getting near to the glacial meltwaters which blew across the country, there are sand dunes. And those sand dunes are from that melt material. It's called loess, and it is a very different type of vegetation, but it's also an open absorbent of rainfall at that end. It doesn't stay around very much. The rainfall might be 40 inches, but it's going to drain into the aquifer fairly quickly. If you're going to have agriculture, practically every piece of agriculture has a center pivot irrigation, and that takes water out of the aquifer. At the moment, the Mahomet Aquifer is not being depleted as much as the Ogallala Aquifer in Nebraska, but this sort of irrigation is very expensive of water. The land is probably worth half the price of land in East Central Illinois. It's light. It's good for early vegetables. I went to the farmer's market yesterday and talked to a person from Mason City, which is in this general area. And so he can grow vegetables there early and come to the farmer's market. The sand dunes are still active. There are scalds where wind will get into the sand dune and blow it open, and so certain plants can tolerate that. There's a love grass or that can be turned around in the wind to the extent that its fruiting body is making a pattern in the sand, and still it's viable. There's goat rue. There's a whole bunch of plants that are able to survive in very dry territory. Some of them have their counterparts in bigger plants that are the equivalent in East Central Illinois. Like there's an evening primrose, which looks like a small version of what even primrose we have here is. There are things like ragweeds, there are mallows, just walking into this uneven landscape and discovering is interesting. And those people who are knowledgeable are very helpful in telling others what is there. And all of a sudden you find a little praying mantis, which is about all of half an inch long, and it's very hard to see because it is camouflage. Or it's a little bug that's on a leaf. You really need a very fine camera to capture these creatures. You also need a lens around your neck to be able to see and identify these little flies or creatures. There may be 2,000 different creatures there in the prairie. Grasshoppers, grasshopper sparrows. So what birds are there? Where do they nest? How do they nest? So you may have a sand ridge, but then in between on the swales you may have black oak, or you may have black oak up on the ridges. There may be areas where birds like swallows can be involved. I found the trip interesting. I've been to the same place a number of times. I used to take field trips there, but it was interesting to go with people who really knew their species. And it was interesting to travel the roads. The roads are narrow, but on either side there's chicory, and then as you get down in the ditch, you get Queen Anne's lace. And it must be due to the lack of funds at the moment, but those corridors are alive and well, and the little pieces of prairie on either side, whether they're in a ditch or on an embankment, are there, and they're the places we need to work with. The one thing that I found most difficult was the air conditioning. The dormitory I was in, you almost needed a blanket in order to sleep. And I just wondered what the energy loss was in those situations. Out in the field, the temperature was something like 99. The bus driver had a thermometer, and it was very hot. But people are used to it, and people who are used to working outside often find modest air conditioning much more satisfactory than very heavy-duty air conditioning. People get used to that heavy air conditioning, but and indeed, like the Union, you tend to, at Illinois, you tend to put on a coat because it's cold. So that it works for people, but it must cost a lot in energy. Sometimes it's because the building was an early user of air conditioning and is not designed properly. So one element of the building may be cold and the other element may be warm, and it's hard to deal with that. So that's probably enough to say something about a rather exciting conference. We don't know where the next one will be. And the last one was in Winnipeg, which is a long, long way away. I want to say now I came back and visited the Lake Park Prairie. And it is absolutely amazing at the moment. There's a forest of compass plants and dock. And these creatures are growing well. They're growing well at the Pope Prairie and Rantoul, too. Ron Sleater will be with me tomorrow. He was at this conference. And we will be cutting the heads off teasels that we didn't get to spot herbicide. They're just getting ripe. So if you have your teasel in the backyard at the moment, it would be very helpful to get it rid of it, because it has thousands of seeds and they stay around for a long time. So getting rid of teasel is a thing. I stopped on Route 45 just yesterday and removed a bunch of teasel that didn't get herbicided. But the little prairie at Lake Park, which took a lot of the soil from Route 45, is doing well. There's some discussion about a prairie. This is a garden prairie, in inverted commas. It has been planted on a cornfield and adjacent to a ditch. Our first task was to be able to grow some sort of vegetation on a 45-degree angle that didn't take the normal roadside vegetation. And it has been tremendously successful. The deep roots of things like purple coneflower have kept the soil together. The little blue stem with about a mile of rootlets underneath it, and big roots, tap roots like compass plant and prairie dock that are almost as big as your thigh. They keep the prairie together. But you also have the challenges that it becomes native. Some of the sunflowers have taken off and decided to increase. Sunflowers have to be watched because they do take over. But the lead plant and the culver's root and a whole bunch of other plants are doing well, and it would be good if you go to the southeast corner of Winfield Village. You can walk through a trail that is 5 feet wide and good enough for two people to be working together and talking to each other. But a few of the silphiums are hanging over, the cordgrass is hanging over. There are not a lot of insects, but they're there. And you can take your lens and find them if you know you entomology a little bit, but it's just exciting to see. This is one of several peaks in the prairie retinue. There'll be a later peak when the grasses come up high. Actually, the grasses are almost there. The turkey foot on a big blue stem is just beginning to appear, but it's amazing the volume of the amount of vegetation there. So some people who are interested in energy conservation would like to see that sort of prairie used in burning for electrical production from a native source, or they would like to take some species that would be potential for providing energy. And how much time?
1 minute.
1 minute, okay. That's enough for now. I will be visiting a eco farm in Sydney this afternoon. And if anyone is interested in that, my phone number is 351-1911 or 840-1911. And I'll give you the details. And thanks for listening. And this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views expressed on the Prairie Monk are solely those of the speakers and no one else. I'll also mention that if you're not out there listening right now, all of these episodes eventually go up on YouTube, and you can tune in some other time. If you simply go to youtube.com and type in The Prairie Monk, that should get you fairly directly to the UPTV channel, where there are now 100 and some episodes of this show. And so you can catch up on what you didn't hear today. Also, I guess it's now noon, time for Shruti Music of India. Again, here on WEFT Champaign, we are community radio for East Central Illinois.